Thank you, Duane, and thank you for the invitation to come speak to you today. Start my own internal clock, and I'll keep an eye on that one. As I'm a bit of a split personality, being split between chemistry and physics, I give talks to audiences which range from biology to high schools to physics audiences, and I've been told to expect sort of a mixed crowd. So I'm going to try to motivate what it is we're studying at a very basic level with the equations there, and show you what we can do in the cells and what have you. If at any point if something is confusing, by all means you can ask me questions on it at the end. Just a picture of McGill as it is today, at least after days like this, or we have hope that it's coming. But just to sort of to give an overview of some of the other things that we do in the lab, and I'm not going to spend much time on this. I'm going to talk today about vector mapping and looking at transport in cells using these fluctuation techniques. We also do some single molecule tracking of receptors in cells tagged with quantum dot nanoparticles, where we get individual trajectories out. We do patterning of extracellular matrix proteins to try to create environments where we can guide neurons and cells. And so we use optical-based techniques to pattern fluorescent proteins in biologically relevant ways, like Einstein. Actually, the first one was Diego Maradona. It was an Argentinian postdoc. Einstein won out in the International Year of Physics over Maradona. Methods to try to get oligomerization states from diffraction limit microscopy by looking at photon count histograms and things like this. And a nonlinear imaging wing where we're doing second harmonic generation imaging of human heart collagen and in disease states, not in live patients. I had to explain that to the building director that we did not have people in open heart surgery in the lab. He thought that for a while. Most recently, just an idea that after seeing a talk on the malaria pigment and seeing the structure of it, I thought it might have a huge nonlinear cross-section. So we switched the filters in the microscope and did third harmonic generation imaging of the hemozoa and the malaria pigment. This is late stage infection. The blue is third harmonic generation at about 1,000-to-1 signal to noise ratio from the hemozoa and pigment. Just the one time in my life that a scientific guess worked the first time. We saturated the detectors. It was briefly wonderful. Now we're pursuing that. In terms of some of the patterning, here's where we've gone. Ultimately, we are using this to generate gradients on which we can guide. Here's a neuron from a chick. This red is a gradient in protein, which we've written in terms of the new optical-based techniques, where we can actually generate whatever contrast we want. And so we now, the Einstein was a binary image. The Vermeer is now where you can control the shades. And this appeared in newspapers. It was on the front page of the Ottawa Citizen, and then the caption was, not scientists can guide neurons, but scientists in Montreal can generate microscopic works of art. And so I got an email from a guy who said, it's my wife, our anniversary coming up, could you do a portrait of her? And I missed the opportunity to have a side business to finance the lab, so Kent would have jumped on that, but thing. I should point out this was largely pioneered by my first postdoc, Santiago Costantino. He's largely responsible for this particular work. He's now a faculty member at U to M. But in terms of today's story, to stay on time track, I wanted to motivate this by sort of establishing systems that I'm going to talk about today. And in terms of showing, this is what motivates me at least for today's talk. And what is this? This is a schizophrenic cell. It's migrating on a glass substrate. What you're seeing is fluorescence imaging in time of the cell. This is not real time. This is a 50-minute time loop. But this is a cell. It's a Chinese hamster ovary cell. Don't ask me. It's a standard cell type used. This cell is active because if you suffered a wound, these cells of this type would become active and migrating in terms of the wound healing. So I'm very much interested in how cells migrate, how neurons negotiate and connect with other neurons, but the questions that I ask are, how is this regulated at the molecular level? This type of imaging is done in many biological labs around the world. I would like to ask, what is happening at the molecular level? What insight can physical science bring to this picture and go beyond the image to tell you something about what's happening there at the molecular level? In terms of the molecules, the red is a protein called paxillin. The green is the green fluorescence coming from a protein called alpha-actinin. More on them later, but you can see these bright areas at the front. Those are things that the biologists call focal adhesions. That's like the foot, anchoring the cell as it migrates. But there's force generation mechanics going on in the system, and it's all occurring at low Reynolds number. So the motivation, what are the molecular rules of the game that motivate the choreography of life or cell in this case, but approaching physical chemical understanding, and we develop ways of actually looking at information from the images to extract such information. In today's talk, I'm going to tell you about two flavors of the correlation spectroscopy that Duane alluded to. One, spatiotemporal image correlation spectroscopy, or STICS. And then, usually when I go to the second topic in biology audiences, people scatter. We go to reciprocal space and the room empties. But in a physics crowd, people begin smiling, actually. And so we're going to go to reciprocal space at the end and the K-space technique and what we can do with that. How do we observe the molecular dance? Well, we need to actually label the molecules of interest in the cell. And most, apart from the nonlinear microscopy that we do, most of what is done in my lab relies on fluorescent probes. And then we actually, through the benefit of a wonderful jellyfish from off Washington State, use the genetically encoded fluorophores, the so-called green fluorescent protein, for which chemistry prize, Nobel Prize, was awarded last year. What is green fluorescent protein? For this talk, basically, we can consider it as a natural protein that came from the jellyfish that can be genetically encoded in cells. It's about 3 nanometers by 4 nanometers. It has a chromophore in the center. If you shine blue light on it, you get green out. In the movies that I'll be showing you, you will see cells in which we have a protein to which we have this genetically tagged a light bulb, a fluorescent protein, so we can actually track things and image things inside the cell. That is a wonderful contribution for doing live cell imaging, quantitative microscopy, but nature is never perfect. In terms of these probes and other fluorescent probes, you will only get a certain amount of photons out of them before some sort of photophysics or photochemistry occurs and you go to a bleached state. So when it's emitting on photobleaching, which we'll hear about later, it turns off, so loss of information. So you'll hear those particular terms. As well, there's not just one flavor or color of the fluorescent protein. Chemists have developed colors across the visible range in which then you can label different components in the cell with different color-emitting proteins. And this has a wide range of uses for tracking multiple things at the same time. Robert Campbell at University of Alberta Chemistry kindly let me use his, he develops them as one of the many groups doing it. He represents them as glowing soup cans, because that's basically what they look like. So I'll show many cases where we've tagged proteins with these particular things. Okay, now, in terms of what we're going to study, I refer to it often as the choreography, dance of life, what have you. It is a very complex Shakespearean play. There are many players, many actors involved. And I mentioned before, reciprocal space scares the biologists. This is the slide which scares the physicists. This is the cartoon picture of what the biological understanding, at least of the players involved in this. At this level, this is the cell of the type that we're going to track. There's the nucleus. The action is occurring at the front of the cell. Something's happening at the back, and it's migrating left to right. In terms of what we're going to look at, we're going to focus down on the bottom membrane of the cell. So you can think in terms of frying an egg. Crack the egg, put it in the pan. These cells are in tissue culture. They spread out. they kind of look like a microscopic egg. We are imaging at the level between the pan and the bottom membrane of the cell. So think of it as a moving egg in which we have fluorescent proteins, green eggs and ham. So in terms of the stage, this is the plasma membrane. It's 5 nanometers in thickness. And the squiggles, these are cellular Velcro. They are integrin proteins. They're heterodimeric. They're made of two components. They bind to the extracellular matrix outside the cell. That was some of the things I was showing in terms of patterning. They bind to the extracellular matrix. The binding event initiates signaling. There's clustering of the integrins. And then there's this recruitment of all these other actors in terms of who come running in off the stage, begin binding, linking things up, signaling. A lot is not known in terms of this very complex process. But ultimately, they link to these filaments. This is the actin cytoskeleton, and there are motor proteins, nanoscale motor proteins, which actually generate the force, which pull on the actin cytoskeleton in order to generate forces in order for cells to migrate. About the acronyms, just every one of those blobs is a different protein with a different name. What we are trying to do is to quantitatively look at how they come together, put a quantitative picture on some of these things, and so we'll be looking at alpha actinin, various types of integrins, TALEN, the actin, and all these other things. So just think of it as a play with multiple players wearing different color hats, and we're trying to figure out the play and look at as it unfolds, but we're facing limits of trying to observe this at a limit, sometimes with low signal to noise. So the challenge, if you've ever seen Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, where the Hamlet's going on in the background and they don't really know what's going on, that's the stage we're at half the time. Okay. So where does the physical picture come in? And that comes in where we actually say, okay, we have a metric, fluorescence, in terms of being able to track the proteins. But for a lot of what we do, we rely on observing the signals, but actually observing fluctuations in the signals. And the techniques that I've worked on are based on an older technique developed at Cornell University in the early 1970s called fluorescence correlation spectroscopy, developed in Walt Webb and Elliot Elson's labs at Cornell. Simple idea, focus laser down inside the sample, and within the beam focus, as fluorescently tagged protein or whatever species move in and out, they get excited while in the beam. But because the observation volume is so small, the fluctuations matter. Statistical mechanics tells us fluctuations scale inversely with the square root of the number of things. In this type of approach, you use a tiny laser focus, which is about maybe a cubic micrometer in size, to define a small system in which the relative fluctuations will be significant. As they move in and out, you collect the fluorescence and onto a detector, and you measure a time series of fluorescence intensity fluctuations as they move in and out of the volume. Fluctuation, simply the deviation from the average for the time series. Two things are important. The magnitude of the fluctuation, which for the relative fluctuation, again, scales inversely with the square root, the number in there, and the time duration, which is going to be more important for this talk. We are focus, that will dictate the average length time scale of the fluctuation. That will tell us something about the transport. Is it moving slowly or quickly? Is it moving in a directed flow, or is it Brownian motion? All of this will affect the characteristic regression time of the fluctuation, and that's the more important thing for this type of for this particular talk. In FCS, this time series would then be analyzed or characterized for statistics in terms of a time autocorrelation function. But what we do differently is, but actually using space in this approach. So think of this as an election poll, where we are polling molecules, but instead of in the election polls, and I don't know if we're going to have one coming up or not, but when they quote the They say 1,000 surveyed in the poll, uncertainty this. We're measuring the uncertainty and getting back the population in that's been polled at the molecular level. Okay. So most of my scientific career has been actually translating from that time domain technique to imaging-based approaches, starting actually with NILS for my PhD, but actually using laser scanning microscopes, fluorescence microscopes, evanescent wave microscopes to generate images, fluorescence images, just as we've been doing biology labs. But for the purpose of what images in my lab is looked at as a matrix of fluctuations. So now we have fluctuations recorded in space and time, and if we've labeled multiple species, wavelength. So we now have the parameters that we can analyze in terms of the fluctuations in fluorescence. That one I just showed was raster scanning, where the laser beam is rastered across, and we build up the image point by point onto a PMT detector. So the image is built up sequentially point by point, and then it rasters back and repeats. What I'll show in this talk is done by evanescent imaging, where we basically don't overfill the objective, but we come in off-axis with the laser beam, and then we, beyond the critical angle, totally internally reflect, generate an evanescent field at the boundary, and because, of course, that decays in the transmitting medium exponentially, the evanescent wave at the boundary only has amplitude sufficient to excite fluorescence from molecules which are about 100 nanometers within 100 nanometers of the interface. So most of the movies that I'll show today are actually generated by this reflection fluorescence microscope, is just using it to excite fluorescence at the boundary. This is useful if you're trying to study that fried egg crawling across the surface. That 100 nanometer resolution allows you to actually resolve what's happening on that bottom membrane, whereas wide field you'd have a lot of background fluorescence. So that's most of what I'll show you in today's. Now, there are many flavors of the image correlation techniques that have appeared over the years. I'm just going to show you first temporal before I actually describe the space-time image correlation. In the temporal image correlation, you would basically take an image series, and then you would go through the pixel stack, and you would build up time and do time autocorrelation of the fluctuations through in time through a given pixel stack, and then average over space. So our correlation function is basically built up as a function of time lag, and we get a time correlation function as a function of time lag, which is basically averaging the fluctuation decays. This is exactly analogous to the FCS case, except on a slower time scale, the imaging time scale, and we would average over space. So actually applying for FCS, or the temporal image correlation, one would fit this decay to the appropriate decay model from which, knowing the beam focus, you could determine the average residency time, and with the appropriate fit model, extract diffusion coefficients, flow speeds, what have you. But as well, from the offset of the correlation function, amount of immobile protein in the system. The Achilles heel of this technique is, I said, appropriate fit model. Flow, diffusion, what have you, have different decays. Flow will give you a Gaussian. Diffusion in a membrane will give you a hyperbolic decay. If you have mixtures, which model do you use? You have to know something ahead of time about what dynamics you expect. And then you're doing sort of model comparison. Out information that's present in the images. And the basis of the Stix technique is actually to more use information that's in the images and actually of measurement in a better way. So the spatiotemporal correlation spectroscopy is to understand. Instead of looking at time correlation through a single pixel, we do spatial correlation over an image and then time correlate after the spatial correlation. And so here I show an animation of a space-time correlation function where we're now looking at spatial lags first, then time lags in generating this time course of the spatial correlations, It's a system in which there's a Brownian motion, a random walker, plus a flow component. And we see basically the central peak split off and move off, representing the flow. We can fit that with a Gaussian and track it and obtain a vector. And we can fit the central for its decay and spread to get a diffusion coefficient. To understand this, I'm just going to ask you to picture yourselves as these green fluorescent protein molecules. It was St. Patrick's Day yesterday, so if there's any residual green beer in the audience, we can use it. Now, if right now you're a semi-captive audience, and if we did imaging from the ceiling, and we did the time series of imaging, right now you are in your seats, not moving. And if everyone's still awake, and it's actually, I'm pretty impressed. If asleep, that's photo bleach, so no information there. But if awake, emitting, engaged, but static. So if we did spatial correlation in time for the static case, the peak just stays in the middle and doesn't move. So if there's immobile proteins in the system, they correlate, and the space-time correlation function doesn't move. Now, we end the seminar, and for the grad students, there's extra pizza or food available. People bolt for the exits. Now, if we're taking the snapshots, we have a net movement, at least of a subset of the population, in a given direction. The fluctuations and correlations of the fluctuations in space-time correlation would be such that we would have a net exit. And then finally, if we have sponsorship of the symposium series from Labatt's, and they provided free beer, and let's add blindfolds, we could create a situation in which we have a random walk, a drunken random walk. And then as we allow things to unfold, nobody gets anywhere on average, but people are moving. For the diffusion, the random walk, the peak would basically spread, do the isotropic diffusion and decay, but it doesn't translate off-axis. All of those things come from space-time correlation, and I should point out this was these students. So-called first idea. What I'm going to show you is getting vectors out of this type of measurement and a lot of the cells and where we've gone with this technique. So here again is a it's just one of these cells. They migrate when they're happy. This is parked by the curb. It's idling, and what's happening is that apparatus, that molecular apparatus, is not engaged, and the motor proteins are basically tugging on the cytoskeletal elements. You can kind of see them as striations in the cell. It's labeled green fluorescent. So if we do the analysis in regions of interest, 16 pixels by 16 pixels, space-time correlation, here's a contour plot of the space-time correlation function, you see the translating peak. Fit that, you get you basically back out a flow vector repeat across the cell. You see these residual spatial correlations? That's correlations of the actin cytoskeleton. So we can actually see that the motion is indeed along the cytoskeletal elements. Repeat the process. We open sample to generate these vector maps across the cell. And we also have to filter for that immobile population. Remember, the immobile contributes at the center and would obscure, at least measuring the initial dynamics, but then, being a physicist, said, hey, let's just go to reciprocal space and time, remove the zero frequency component, remove the static, then do the analysis, and boom, the dynamic. Here's a simulation that just illustrates that. Simulation, so not a cell, artificial, but we're modeling diffraction limit imaging. We have two-point particle populations, basically delta functions that we convolve with a Gaussian, and 90% is immobile, and there's a small end of population. Do the filter to remove the static component and correlation, and you can see it, the translation plus the diffusion in that. When we first measured it on the cells, I said, Ben, you're going to see flow, it's going to, but it was a lot of immobile, but filtering, which revealed the dynamics. If that cell, that green cell we just looked at, then we could generate a vector map of the, this is alpha actinin, bound to the actin, and we get actually quantitative results, which the white vector. That's one that was below signal to noise, so it fit to a distant noise correlation and it looked like it was moving faster than ever. My first honor student at McGill, they were doing analysis of the older time image correlation fitting for flow and diffusion, and this one guy from New York, he was a very ambitious student, came to me and he said, here are the results, and I said, Nature publication, and his eyes lit up, and he said, what? And I said, that velocity you have, and he looks at it, and he goes, that's almost the speed of light, and I said, relativistic proteins. Don't tell anyone, it's unpublished to this day, but it was however, when I generated this vector map, it was fortunate, like, it made a and I was an experimental test case at McGill as sort of a first experimental biophysicist, and you're trying to prove yourself in many communities. And so when I had vectors on cells, they said, this must be biophysics. So for the biologists, because they're like, well, we know the actin's moving. What else can you do? Cartoon picture of what we were looking at, all of those players were coming together in a choreography, and they were forming dance partners, coming together to you have to actually begin is being moved in a flow pattern. Our Rosencrantz, Guildenstern, Hamlet, everyone, that for this purposes, it they're just proteins with different names. And then compare, this is alpha-5 integrin, paxillin, focal adhesion kinase, talin, vinculin, all players in this play. And the rationale was then, if they're part of a common complex and the actin is being driven in a flow, if they're attached to the actin, we should see correlation in direction and magnitude for the two vectors and the two channels. So we compare magnitude. There's a lot more data. I wanted to highlight one piece of this due to time limitations. This is for one type of cell under one type of experimental condition. But what we saw is the integrin, most of it wasn't mobile. That which was mobile did not correlate in terms of direction and magnitude with the actin. Actinin, which binds to the actin, correlated direction and magnitude with an error about 1. Actin-binding protein correlates with the actin. We were happy with that. Several other points correlated to intermediate level, and what this suggested to us that these were part of a complex that was coming on and off the actin. While on the actin, it gets carried along and we have correlation in magnitude and direction. When it comes off, it's like a decoherence. We lose the correlation. So this thing that's complex what's coming off. And so we posted, again, a cartoon picture in which we at least have some suggesting that we have this common complex coming on and off the actin. In order to generate the force, has to be linked up and coming together. Interestingly, Claire Waterman's story in Guttenstein published 1 month later almost the identical story using speckle microscopy. Two different groups coming up, same thing, almost identical cell systems. If you think about what I showed you, I've only showed you implicit interactions because the analysis said, let's do a vector comparison for direction and magnitude. And what got me thinking about this was I grew up in Nova Scotia, and it's like admitting I grew up in Nova Scotia, and we didn't have advanced daycare. So we used to get. Yeah, my mother would say, "Go out and play, and if you make it back at night, that's good." Went to grad school or whatever. But at McGill, they have one of these newfangled advanced daycares, and one day I was crossing the street, and you know they have the ropes all the kids hold together as part of, and they're part of a common complex, and we were both crossing. But it's like, hey, if we did the analysis, we would get common vectors not holding hands with the daycare kids. So, film, right? How do you distinguish inherent in those images? Because we have two channels, but we haven't extended the cross-fluctuation analysis as far. Here is the Leafs Habs analogy. And so in my lab, a student from Toronto, Dave Colin, you'll hear about his work next after this part. Dave was a die-hard Toronto Maple Leaf fan, so he died a lot and died hard. It's just something off the net, but Dave started dating a local Montreal girl, Elaine, and Elaine was a die-hard Montreal Canadiens fan. And they agreed not to talk about hockey, but they would go to the games together. Colors to the center. And you observe the two of them sitting next to each other. If you say, two channels in space and time, and you see that they come to the game together. They go to the concession stand together, and they go to the bar together at the end of the game. We have correlations which are non-random that extend in space and time, and it tells us that they are indeed a couple. In order to pick that information, appropriate sampling, and enough correlations in space and time to see cells. Now we cross fluctuations, channel 1, channel 2, and we have different components. For time, act in with a green and a red probe, so the filaments are level with both colors, so we should see the cross-correlation, and you see the cross-correlation. So, real. Transient. You see the cross-correlation turn on when the adhesions are active, when the cell is actually turning over things, and then it turns off. And so you actually see the onset, and you do. Unfortunately, I couldn't get it for the cross-correlation day in time. You tell the students, "I'm speaking in Toronto," and they're like, "When?" I'm like, 3 days. And they're like, "Haha." So, you can visually see the effect of the drawing destabilizing the filamentous actin. Trying to guide the neurons and look at them, their turning behavior as we squirt attractant drugs or repellent drugs. And comfort zone of physics. So the switching to case-space image correlations. And I said, no, this was actually, this one was not.